Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now in Ezra chapter 4. I'm going to cover the entire chapter, verses 1 through 24, in this audio, and I will call this audio, Adversaries Cause the Rebuilding of the Temple to Cease. Our year is 536 BC when they started and stopped working on the foundation. Our context is this. In chapter 3 of Ezra, we saw the Israelites rebuilding the altar, offering a lot of burnt offerings on the altar, and they built the foundation of the temple. Things are going pretty good. Chapter 3, but now they run into opposition in chapter 4. We start now at Ezra 4, verses 1 through 5. Now, when the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the people of the exile were building a temple to the Lord God of Israel, they approached Zerubbabel and the heads of fathers' households and said to them, "Let us build with you, for we, like you, seek your God, and we have been sacrificing to him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us up here." But Zerubbabel and Jeshua and the rest of the heads of fathers' households of Israel said to them, "You have nothing in common with us in building a house to our God, but we ourselves will together build to the Lord God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us." Then the people of the land discouraged the people of Judah and frightened them from building and hired counselors against them to frustrate their counsel all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. All right, so we start in verse 1 now. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard, again, our time frame is this. This is 536 B.C. If you recall, Cyrus, the king of Persia, Cyrus II, he had conquered Babylonia in 539 and taken over the Mesopotamian Valley where Babylonia had recently ruled. In the same year or thereabouts, he issued the Edict of Cyrus in 539, which said, "Jews, you can go back to Israel and rebuild your temple and your city and your walls." So the Jews took him up on that kind offer and returned to Israel in 538, and they start working and finish laying the foundation of the temple in 536. Now, the enemies of Judah and Benjamin, those are the people of basically Samaria, the northern kingdom of Israel, who consisted of a polyglot nation of ethnicities taken from all over the ancient Near East when the Assyrians had wiped out the northern kingdom of Israel, Samaria for short. Their capital was Samaria. That happened in 722 BC after a long siege, and Sargon II took over actually in that year and exported a bunch of northern Israelites, Jews, all over the empire, and thus formed the contingent of the lost 10 tribes. And then, as per Assyrian policy, Sargon and his successors also, they would import people from the Assyrian Empire. They would take them out of their hometowns and put them into the conquered territory, in this case, Samaria, the northern kingdom. And the reason they did that was so that the local populations would be uprooted and not as likely to have local loyalties that might lead to revolts against the Persian central government. And so that's where these enemies came from. Judah and Benjamin, those are the two tribes of the southern nation of Judah, but we're going to call them Israel now since they represent the whole nation now. They heard about the temple. They approached Zerubbabel. He's the leader of the Jews, the grandson of Jehoiakim, the Jewish king in exile, who's in prison in Babylon. They approach, the enemies of Israel do, they approach Zerubbabel and the heads of fathers' households. That's the political structure under Zerubbabel, tribal-type structure, family heads. And the enemies say to Zerubbabel and company, "Let us build with you." How nice. The enemy's intent is not clear. Now, perhaps they wanted to pervert the temple for their own purposes. Maybe they intended to cause strife to hinder the work. Perhaps they would have truly joined in the work, provided they would be permitted to continue their own perverted worship in the temple. I suspect that's what it was. They just wanted to have a big temple so they could stick their God in there along with Yahweh, along with the worship of Yahweh. So the Israelites' enemies tried syncretism before they went to persecution. The persecution is going to come later. Now, the enemies of Israel here mention Esarhaddon. He ruled 681 to 669, who brought us here. So we see that the kings of Assyria were still importing people into Samaria after the times of Sargon II, who ruled from 722 to 705. Sennacherib was after him. But these kings of Assyria were bringing in these pagans who, of course, had pagan gods. Now, this process, which the Assyrians employed, is described for us in 2 Kings 17:24. Then the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cuthah, Ava, Hamath, and Sepharvaim. These places are unknown to us. They're basically either on the Euphrates or the Tigris River. I went over them in great detail in 2 Kings chapter 17. I won't go over them again, but there are places in Mesopotamia from whence pagans were brought by the Assyrians and dumped into Samaria, into the northern kingdom. So the king of Assyria settled these people in places in place of the Israelites in the cities of Samaria. The settlers took possession of Samaria and lived in its cities, and that's where we get the Samaritans from. Eventually, they're going to be called Samaritans. Now they're just enemies of Israel. So the Assyrians switched out natives of the northern kingdom for peoples of the Assyrian Empire. Now, at first, these people did not worship the true God, but they were eventually taught about God. We read in 2 Kings 17, verses 27 through 28, "Then the king of Assyria issued a command, 'Send back one of the priests you deported. Have him go and live there so he can teach them the requirements of the God of the land.' So one of the priests they had deported, the Assyrians had deported, came and lived in Bethel, and he began to teach them how they should fear Yahweh." Now, why did the king of Assyria do this? Well, it was because the settlers in Samaria, in the northern former Norman kingdom, they were upset because lions were eating them up. They figured that Yahweh, he was the local God in their eyes. He was angry with them, and so they wanted to figure out how they could appease Yahweh. So they sent for a priest. The king of Assyria obliged them and sent a priest back to Israel. So they were taught about the true God, and they did attempt to worship him in a way, but these people also worshiped their false gods as they had in their Assyrian homelands. We are expressly told that they continued in their false, perverted form of worship, even as they professed to honor God. We read in 2 Kings 17, verses 32 through 34, "They feared the Lord, but they also appointed from their number priests to serve them in the shrines of the high places. They feared the Lord, but they also worshiped their own gods according to the custom of the nations where they had been deported from. They are still practicing the former customs to this day." That's probably Jeremiah's day. He probably wrote Kings. "None of them fear the Lord or observe their statutes and ordinances, the laws and commandments the Lord commanded the descendants of Jacob." So you see, these people were classic syncretists. Yeah, we love God, but we love other gods too. And that's not the way it works. God said, "You shall have no other gods before me," or even equal to God. Yahweh is the one true God, the one and only God. And so Zerubbabel and company did exactly the right thing and said, "No, you're not going to build the temple with us. You have nothing in common with us." And they might respond, "Yes, we do. We worship Yahweh." Well, no, that doesn't count. That's nothing. You have nothing in common with us. It's like a liberal Protestant wants to worship with me. He doesn't believe in Jesus. He believes the Bible's full of errors, and that's all he can talk about. It's how Jesus, well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't rise from the dead. We just can't know. No, I got nothing in common with syncretists like that. Compromises with the world, the flesh, and the devil. And so that's a good teaching point here. Syncretism is bad business. Now, this stand for the exclusivism of Yahweh cost the Israelites because they had to suffer undying enmity from the pagan peoples around them, just like Christians today. When we say there's only one way to Jesus, oh, that really irritates people, and they come after you. They won't stop coming after you. It's never going to stop. They hated the master. They hate the servant. But Zerubbabel did the right thing. And so now we see the reaction, the price to pay for standing up for the truth. Verse 4, "The people of the land discouraged the people of Judah and frightened them from building." Well, how did they discourage the people of Judah? How did they frighten them from building? Verse 5 probably tells us the answer. The main way they did that, they hired counselors against the Israelites, the Judahites. They hired counselors against them to frustrate their counsel. All the days of Cyrus, even until the reign of Darius. Now, Cyrus, of course, reigned 559 to 530. We are now in 536. So the harassment from the Persian government, which is coming, instigated by these local enemies, started during the reign of Cyrus, 536, 6 years before Cyrus died. And it continued, this harassment did, even until the reign of Darius, who ruled 521 to 486. Now remember, the temple was built in 520, the rebuilt temple, the second temple. And so there, 1 year there between 521 and 520, I'm sure they still complained about the temple. And after that, it was they complained about the city and the walls. Well, what does it mean in verse 5 that the enemies of Israel hired counselors against them? Well, what they did is they bribed Cyrus's royal favorites. I'm sure there were some Persian officials in Jerusalem at this time, helping the Israelites with their government and keeping an eye on them. And so the enemies found who wanted to have their palms greased, and they greased their palms. And then these Persian officials in Judea sent word back to the king in Babylon, and they said, "We've got a bunch of rebels out here in Israel. You need to take care of these guys." And so that's what the Israelites were up against. We now go to verses 6 and 7 of Ezra 4. Now in the reign of Ahasuerus, that's Xerxes the First, he reigned from 486 to 465. Remember, Ezra came to Israel in 458, right in the middle of Xerxes the First's reign. This is the same Xerxes that was married to the famous Queen Esther. Now in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, they, that's the enemies of Israel, wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. And in the days of Artaxerxes, that's Artaxerxes I, he ruled from 465 to 424. Remember, Ezra came over to Israel right in the middle of that time at 458. And in the days of Artaxerxes, Bishlam, Mithridath, Tabeel, and the rest of his colleagues wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia. And the text of the letter was written in Aramaic and translated from Aramaic. Now, this is confusing here because this letter has nothing to do with the temple. This is, in fact, it's not even in 536. It jumps ahead all the way to the time of Xerxes I, which is 486, not 536, but 486. The reason for this is that Ezra is trying to give examples of opposition, and he just picks a letter he's found in the archives, probably. Remember, Ezra is in Babylon at the time. He's an exilic prophet. And he gets the letter that has to do with the complaints of these enemies complaining about the rebuilding of the city and the walls, not the temple. The temple had already been built by the time of this letter, because this is in the reign of Xerxes, 486 to 465. The temple was built in 516, which was a good at least 30 years earlier than this. But that's confusing, so we got to remember now we've jumped ahead now to the complaints about the city and the wall, not the temple. Now, in the beginning of Xerxes' reign, the enemies of Israel wrote an accusation against Judah. Nothing else is known about this accusation. We can speculate quite reasonably that the accusation probably accused Israel of wanting to betray Cyrus. They don't want to pay tribute anymore. That's how that goes. Well, that's an unknown accusation, and that's an example of the enemies of Israel harassing Israel. And verse 7 says, "Into the days of Artaxerxes," that's Artaxerxes the First, who ruled after Xerxes from 465 to 424. And remember, Ezra came over in 458. So this is right after Ezra came over to Israel. "In the days of Artaxerxes the First, Bishlam, Mithridath, Tabeel, and the rest of his colleagues wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia, and the text of the letter was written in Aramaic and translated from Aramaic." Now let me go back and mention this chronology problem. I said that we jumped ahead to the time of Xerxes the First, 486 to 465, when the context of Ezra chapter 4 is 536 at the laying of the foundation of the temple. And how do we solve that problem? And I just solved it by saying that the letter that Ezra inserts here is just an example of opposition, not meant to be taken chronologically precisely. But some commentators, a lot of the old commentators, said that Ahasuerus was a common name for Persian kings, and it doesn't necessarily refer to Xerxes. Benson says it probably refers to Pseudo-Smerdis. He reigned in 522, and Adam Clark goes along with that. Gill says that many people think it's Cambyses, who ruled from 529 to 522. Well, you notice those two kings finished ruling before the temple was finished. They finished ruling in 522. The temple was finished in 520, so therefore this could refer to the building of the temple that these people were complaining about. Poole states that Cambyses, who ruled from 529 to 522, he was known to be unfriendly to the Jewish nation and religion, and therefore it's unlikely that he would have passed on an opportunity to harass the Jews. Well, I think that's whistling Dixie past the graveyard. Ahasuerus is Xerxes the First. in my humble opinion. So the letters that are quoted by Ezra here are letters that were written nearly 80 years later than the account into which they were placed. But Ezra was not being deceptive by placing the letters here in this book. He clearly dated them by the ruler under which they were written. He said, Ahasuerus. He's mentioned Cyrus in verse 5. He's mentioned Darius in verse 5 also. He's mentioned Ahasuerus in verse 6 and verse 7. He mentions Artaxerxes the first. He wasn't trying to be deceptive. He wasn't confused. He knew exactly who was ruling when. Any contemporary of the writing of Ezra would have clearly seen what Ezra was logically doing. The inhabitants of Israel, when the book of Ezra was written, would know what Ezra was doing. He's just jumping ahead, getting some ammo to prove that the nations surrounding Jerusalem were nasty. He was showing that the opposition to Israel was pervasive and continuing long into the future, beyond the complaints about the rebuilding of the temple. Now, there's one little minor problem here. In verse 7, this letter that Bishlam, Mithridath, and Tabeel and the rest of their colleagues wrote to Artaxerxes is said to be written in Aramaic and translated from Aramaic. Well, that is, to me, was a little bit obscure, and I spent a lot of time trying to figure out exactly what was meant. I discovered that most of my commentators say that the letter was written in the Aramaic language and the Aramaic script. Well, what does that mean? Well, just like you can take the Chinese language spoken orally and listen to it and then transcribe it into Romanize it into English letters that we can read. And for example, you get XI, JING, PING, Xi Jinping. I think that's his pinyin name. I might be wrong. XI is Xi, Jing is JING, and Ping is PING. But that's not how the Chinese see it. They see the squiggly characters. So the script is different than the language. The language is that which is spoken orally, and the script is how you write it down on paper. And so all the commentators say that what's happened here, the letter was written in Aramaic, both in the Aramaic language, which was spoken by these enemies, and translated, i.e. written down on paper in Aramaic. I don't get that by reading the text here. It doesn't sound like that, but that's what all the commentators say. Well, let's just assume they're right for a moment and ask the question, well, why was the letter written in Aramaic? Well, Aramaic was the lingua franca of the time. Everybody in the ancient Near East spoke Aramaic, especially the traders and the big shot politicians and the diplomats. And this is a diplomatic letter, of course. It's going from Persian officials to the Persian court back in Babylon. And so it's going to be in Aramaic. Now let's look at how other versions translate this phrase, translated. The letter was translated. The KJV and the Darby translation say that the letter was written in Aramaic and interpreted in the Syrian tongue, which doesn't really help too much. The ESV says the letter was written in the Syrian tongue and set forth in the Syrian tongue, which goes along with the idea of saying it was written in Aramaic character. Syrian is Aramaic. God's Word says that the letter was translated into the Aramaic language. Well, from all of that, I'm going to give you my two options as to what's actually meant here. And again, I'm not a biblical scholar. I'm just trying to do the best I can. So option number one is that this letter was written in the local dialect of the enemies of Israel there, the Samaritans, and then it was translated into Aramaic, both the Aramaic language and using the Aramaic script for writing. That's one option. Another option is it was written in Aramaic by Rehum and Shimshai, who we will meet in verse 8. Those are the two Persian officials who took the local dialect of the complainers and wrote and actually translated the dialect in Aramaic and sent the letter to Artaxerxes. And by the way, when the letter got to Artaxerxes, he had it translated into Persian. Ezra 4 verse 18, the letter you sent us has been translated and read in my presence. But I think that's a different translation. That's talking about going from Aramaic to Persian, but getting from the local dialect to Aramaic, I suspect was done by these two Persian officials, Rehum and Shimshai. I called him Shimshai, S-H-I-M-S-H-A-I. It is a minor point. I'm interested in it, though, because I was living for years in China before I realized that of all the dialects spoken in China, they all use the same script. The written language is the traditional Chinese characters, or the Chinese characters that we all know and love when we see them on Chinese restaurants. And these different dialects are spoken by people who cannot understand each other. And so if they're lost in a street or something and need help, they write the characters down on a piece of paper, show it to somebody else, and it's perfectly understood. Different languages, same script. The script is not the same thing as the language. It took me a long time to figure that out. Well, at any rate, that is a rabbit trail. So now let's return to the main path here. Ezra 4, 8 through 10. Rehum, the commander, and Shimshai, the scribe, wrote a letter against Jerusalem to King Artaxerxes. That's Artaxerxes I, who ruled from 465 to 424. Then wrote Rehum, the commander, and Shimshai, the scribe, and the rest of their colleagues, the judges and the lesser governors, the officials, the secretaries, the men of Erech, the Babylonians, the men of Susa, that is the Elamites, and the rest of the nations which the great and honorable Osnappar deported and settled in the city of Samaria and in the rest of the region beyond the river. That's the Euphrates River. Now this Rehum and Shimshai, as I said, I believe are the Persians who were persuaded to write the letter to Artaxerxes the First. Ellicott commentator backs me up on that, and I think they're right. So this letter is the same letter that was mentioned that was translated into Aramaic in verse 7. Now, Rehum and Shimshai were Persian officials who were in Jerusalem, probably, and they, signing the letter along with them, were other officials, colleagues, the scripture says here in NASB translation, the judges and lesser governors, the officials, the secretaries, and these are officials of the surrounding areas. Now, the surrounding areas that are mentioned, I remember the first time I read this, I had no idea, but after I read some ancient Near Eastern history, which I did, in order to try to get a feel for the context of the Old Testament, the names are very familiar to me now. Erech, Susa, Elamites, extraordinarily familiar because they were big in ancient Near Eastern history. Well, let's start with Erech. That was an ancient city in Mesopotamia. It was located northwest of Ur on the Euphrates River. They found the archaeology there. It was one of the greatest cities of Sumer. Sumer was the ancient civilization that was in the southern Mesopotamian Valley, present-day southern Iraq, right before you get to the Persian Gulf, between the Tigris and the Euphrates River. The beginnings of the Sumerian civilization was about the fifth millennium BC. That's in the 4000s BC. That's a long time ago. Recorded history doesn't really start till 3000 BC. Before then, it's archaeology, which is iffy to me. But at any rate, by 3000, a flourishing Sumerian civilization existed, and that civilization gradually exerted power over the surrounding area in the southern Mesopotamian Valley. And finally, the civilization of Sumer culminated in the Akkadian dynasty, A-K-K-A-D-I-A-N. And that dynasty was founded by a famous king called Sargon I in 2340 BC, approximately. That's the king that was so famous that Sargon II of Assyria named himself after Sargon I, most probably. He, of course, was in 722 BC when he took over and conquered northern Israel. But at any rate, Sumer declined after 2000, and the Mesopotamian Valley principalities were later absorbed by Assyria first and then Babylonia. The Sumerians are believed to have invented the cuneiform system of writing, which is, of course, a famous system of writing on the monuments. The whole story of ancient Near Eastern history is absolutely fascinating. I know very little about it, but I know that when you start talking about seeing how they translated these systems of writing, like cuneiform on one hand or hieroglyphics on another, or the Egyptian demonic, or how they use the Rosetta Stone. It's all very, very interesting stuff. But anyway, Erech was one of the great cities of Sumer, right near Abraham's family stomping grounds from Ur. Reminds me when I was on a tour in Italy, and a retired military officer had been over there in the Middle East because of the Iraqi war, and he said he was walking around ancient Babylon, looking at the ancient ruins, and then he was talking to an archaeologist who said, "Yeah, we think we found Abraham's house." I said, "Abraham, what Abraham are you talking about?" "Abraham in the Bible. Yeah, we think we know where he lived." These archaeologists are something else. I've always wanted to know. I haven't had a chance to research it to know whether they've actually done that. I doubt it, but that archaeologist, again, this is third hand, you're getting it fourth hand, that archaeologist apparently believed it. But at any rate, Erech is a well-known place. And then the Babylonians, of course, are the people who were from the Babylonian Empire that were under Nebuchadnezzar, which got overthrown by the Persians in 539. the Persians just kind of went east a little bit over the Tigris River, and then now they've got the Mesopotamian Valley. And the men of Susa, Susa's a well-known city. Daniel ended up his days there in Susa, died in Susa. Susa is in the southwestern corner of the Persian Empire, right to the east of the Tigris River, down there near the Persian Gulf. And Susa was the capital of an old kingdom that was there before the Persians were there, the Elamite kingdom. Elam, E-L-A-M. Elam was established east of the Tigris River there before 3000 B.C. It was known for its warlike people and was traditionally thought to have descended from Noah's son Shem. But again, you read ancient Near Eastern history and Elam shows up all the time. Verse 10 says that the rest of the nations who signed this letter, they were from the nations that the great and honorable Osnapar deported and settled in the city of Samaria and in the rest of the region beyond the river. The river is the Euphrates. In other words, the people that are signing this letter are the people who have been deported by the Assyrian king and have been taken from the Assyrian Empire and dumped into Samaria, northern Israel. It also says the city of Samaria, incidentally, not just the region of Samaria, the kingdom of Samaria, which is shorthand for the northern kingdom of Israel. Osnapar, the name even sounds Assyrian. It's most probably Ashurbanipal, who ruled from 669 to 631. He, of course, would be continuing the deportation done by his father, Esarhaddon, who ruled from 681 to 669. And you could go even further than that, Sennacherib, Sargon II. Lots of deportations and transporting of tribes through the Assyrian Empire. We go now to Ezra chapter 4, verses 11 through 16. This is the copy of the letter which they sent to him, the they being Rehum and Shimshai, the two Persian officials. Rehum is called a commander. The Holman Christian Study Bible has him as a governor, a political leader, not a military leader. Shimshai was a scribe. Of course, scribes were important in the government because they were the only ones that could write and send diplomatic messages. This is the copy of the letter which they sent to him, Ezra says in Ezra 4:11, to King Artaxerxes, your servants. Again, Artaxerxes is 485 to 424, his rule. Your servants, the men in the region beyond the river, that's the Euphrates River. The region beyond the river, of course, is Israel, namely northern Israel, Samaria. And now let it be known to the king that the Jews who came up from you have come to us at Jerusalem. They are rebuilding the rebellious and evil city, and are finishing the walls and repairing the foundations. Now let it be known to the king that if that city is rebuilt and the walls are finished, they will not pay tribute, custom, or toll, and it will damage the revenue of the kings, the Assyrian kings. Now because we are in the service of the palace, and it is not fitting for us to see the king's dishonor, therefore we have sent and informed the king so that a search may be made in the record books of your fathers. And you will discover in the record books and learn that the city is a rebellious city and damaging to kings and provinces, and that they have incited revolt within it in past days. Therefore, that city was laid waste, referring to Jerusalem. We inform the king that if that city is rebuilt and the walls are finished, as a result, you will have no possession in the province beyond the river, beyond the Euphrates River, i.e. in Israel. Now in verse 12, the upset enemies of Israel, let it be known to Artaxerxes that the Jews were rebelling and rebuilding the city and the walls, but no mention of the temple. And that shows that this letter is not written back in 536 BC when Ezra was originally starting out this chapter in the time frame, because Artaxerxes was way past 536. He didn't start ruling to 485. And that's why there's no mention of the temple here in this verse 12, only the city and the walls. The temple, remember, was finished in 516, and we're now somewhere between 485 and 424 during the reign of Artaxerxes. Now, the enemies of Israel asked the king of Assyria, Artaxerxes, to search your records. Why? To find instances of Jewish revolt, which, of course, is going to be easy to find. But they're taking a risk here because there was also in those same archives a certain decree from King Cyrus in 539 or so that says, let the Israelites go back to Israel and let them rebuild the temple. Rebuild the walls and the temple, for that matter. And the enemies of Israel are taking a chance that that decree would not be found. Apparently it wasn't. They might not have known that Cyrus's decree actually existed, but I find that hard to believe. That was such a famous decree. I'm sure the Jews would have talked about it, and the enemies of Israel would have heard about it eventually. Now, at verse 15, the enemies of Israel tell the Assyrian king Artaxerxes, look, you make a search, and you're going to find something very interesting. You're going to find that Jerusalem is a rebellious city. Well, that was very true, especially in the times of Jehoiakim and Zedekiah, the two kings who had 11-year reigns in that period after Josiah died and before 586 B.C. when the city was destroyed by the Babylonians. They were very rebellious. Jehoiakim, of course, went to Egypt for help. Zedekiah refused to pay tribute one time. That's well known, and I'm sure the Jews knew it, and the enemies of the Jews knew it. So, no question, they have incited revolt within that city in the past, as verse 15 claims. Therefore, that city was laid waste. That's true. That's why Nebuchadnezzar II decided to wipe it out, to wipe Jerusalem out in 586 B.C. So, they're making a strong case here. And then, of course, they appeal to what every king is worried about, money, revenues, because the Assyrian Empire got all of its wealth from tribute paid from conquered kingdoms. And verse 16 says, the enemies of Israel said, we inform the king that if the city is rebuilt and the walls finished, you're not going to have a possession anywhere past the Euphrates River, i.e. in Jerusalem. It'll be over. So we go now to Ezra 4, verses 17 through 23. Then the king, that's Artaxerxes I, sent an answer to Rehum the commander, the governor, to Shimshai the scribe, and to the rest of their colleagues who live in Samaria and in the rest of the provinces beyond the river. Notice it's not just Samaria. It's also, I'm sure, all the Aramean kingdoms. They got a decree out toward Phoenicia on the coast, Tyre and Sidon. I'm not sure exactly what the political geography of the time looked like, what the map looked like, but all these places were run by the Persian Empire. They had Egypt by this time. Cambyses, in the early 500s, had gotten Egypt, but I'm not sure Egypt would be included in this decree. At any rate, this decree goes out, and it said this, peace. Great way to start a document, peace. And now the document which you sent to us has been translated and read before me, and there the translation would be from Aramaic to Persian so that the king could understand the language, Aramaic being the diplomatic language and Persian the language the king spoke. Verse 19, a decree has been issued by me, a decree to search the archives, and a search has been made, and it has been discovered that the city has risen up against the kings in past days. That city has risen up, that city being Jerusalem. Yep, you're right. That rebellion and revolt have been perpetrated in it. Yep, Artaxerxes says, you're right, enemies of Israel. Verse 20, and that mighty kings have ruled over Jerusalem, governing all the provinces beyond the river. That's true. David and Solomon ruled all the way to the Euphrates River. That included the Aramean kingdoms in between Israel and the Euphrates River, and that tribute, custom, and toll were paid to them, to those kings. Solomon and David, for example, took tribute. So now issue a decree to make these men stop work, the people that are working on the city and the wall, that this city may not be rebuilt until a decree is issued by me. In other words, we're going to take it easy here till I get to research this a little further. Beware of being negligent in carrying out this matter. The letter continues, why should damage increase to the detriment of the king? Of the kings, meaning the kings of Assyria. Then as soon as the copy of King Artaxerxes' document, I guess Artaxerxes is talking for all the Assyrian kings, referring to the kingdom of Assyria as being the kingdom of the kings of Assyria. Then as soon as the copy of King Artaxerxes' document was read before Rehum and Shimshai the scribe and their colleagues, that's back in Jerusalem, that's in Babylon. Then they went back to Jerusalem. They went in haste to Jerusalem to the Jews and stopped them by force of arms. Now, a few minor points here. Most of this is self-explanatory, but verse 20, Artaxerxes mentions that his archives say that mighty kings have ruled over Jerusalem. Some people have speculated that the only two mighty kings that the documents that Artaxerxes was referring to, the only two kings were Menachem, 752-742 in northern Israel, and Josiah, 646-09 in the southern Israel. Why? Because those are the only two kings that have been identified in the inscriptions of Assyria and Babylonia, as the Cambridge commentator says. But the Cambridge commentator further says there's no need to limit the allusion to these two kings. David and Solomon would be in the oral history of the Jews, and the word would have gotten out to the Persians. I mentioned David and Solomon as I was going through, because it was clear that they took tribute from the kingdoms all the way to the Euphrates. Cambridge speculates that other kings could have been meant by this. Omri, Jeroboam II, Uzziah, Jotham may have been meant, so who knows? The point is that the Jewish king showed up in the archives of Persia. And remember, the archives of Persia would include the previous archives of Babylonian Media, the empire that Persia, the Medo-Persian Empire, that Babylon had conquered. Now in verse 21, Artaxerxes sends a letter and says, the work must stop until a decree, meaning a further decree, is issued by me. In other words, I might change my mind and issue a decree to let them start building again. Now that shows some hesitation on Artaxerxes' part. He could have suspected that his petitioners were biased in what they were saying. Could have. I bet he was suspicious because everybody presents petitions to these ancient kings that are so biased it's not funny. And Artaxerxes must have known something about Cyrus's favorable attitude toward the Jews. What, that was 538? And Artaxerxes started his rule in 465. And Cyrus issued his famous Cyrus Edict, the Edict of Cyrus, in 538 BC, 50 or 60 years earlier. That's not an awful long time for him to have forgotten what Cyrus did, letting the Jews go back. He might have. He might have figured the Jews are just some little kingdom out there, and I don't, well, that's possible. But for whatever reason, whether because he's aware of Cyrus's previously favorable attitude toward the Jews, or rather, because he suspects that his petitioners are not giving him the straight truth here, he's going to investigate further. So we go now to verse 24, Ezra 4, and we will finish this audio. Then work on the house of God in Jerusalem ceased, and it was stopped until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. I've often wondered whether biblical writers could pass basic English because they don't worry too much about context, transitions. Because when you read verse 24, it feels like you jumped from the time of Artaxerxes in the 480s, 70s, and 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s, and 20s. He ruled for a lot. Well, he was from 465 to 424. You jump all the way from that time, all the way back to the time of the laying of the foundation of the temple, which is 536, which is a good 60, 70, 80 years earlier. Why did Ezra do that? Well, recall, he inserts this letter sent to Artaxerxes about the building of the temple and the walls merely to show that the people around Israel were opposed to them. But his main point is to show opposition about rebuilding the temple. And so we see in verse 24, work on the house of God, that would be the temple, in Jerusalem ceased because of the opposition. It was stopped until the second year of the reign of Darius, and that's Darius the First. He ruled from 521 to 486. The second year of his reign is 520, and that, of course, is when the temple was finished. So from 536, well, excuse me, when the temple was restarted, the work on the temple was restarted in 520, was finished in 516. And so from 536 to 520, no work on the temple. Now, what I just said about Ezra jumping back into the building of the temple in 536 and the previous letter to Artaxerxes being inserted from verses 9 through 23, that is backed up by an article by Walward and Zuck. Walward, of course, the famous dispensational scholar. I don't know who Zuck is. And they have convinced me, makes more sense to me. And one of my commentators, unfortunately, I didn't write down which one, said that this stopping of the building of the temple is what started the famous animosity between Jews and Samaritans. Remember the story of the Good Samaritan, how the Jews and the Samaritans didn't like each other? Well, the Samaritans stopped the Israelites from rebuilding their famous second temple. That's pretty plausible to me. At any rate, we have now finished Ezra chapter 4. We are prepared to go in our next audio to Ezra chapter 5, verses 1 through 17, and we will see the rebuilding of the temple begin anew in 536 BC. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.